it all set, or do I need to?
Yeah.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Walt, and I'm an alcoholic. Sober tonight by the grace of God and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a delight and privilege to be in this room. My story, a lot of my early sobriety was in this church, and particularly in the room across the hall. My formative AA years, I spent traveling and touring with the Westfield crowd, starting Monday nights over there at the 12 and 12 meeting, Tuesdays across the street at St. Paul's, Wednesday back here, and then Thursday over at Willow Grove, Friday back here, and so on and so on. Westfield Diner just about every night of the week, because I had nowhere else to go and nothing else to do. I knew the Happy Waitress special each and every night of the week. Not that I got it, but because I was just there so damn often. And man, I could just say those waitresses were not happy. I don't know where they came up with that term. But listen, they were putting up with a bunch of drunks in the back room who were probably not tipping very well. So I don't blame them. You know, a little bit about me. I grew up in the town next door in Clark, Union County native boy. I haven't left. I'm still here. I've still been sober and firmly planted in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, in this particular environs, if you will. My path and my journey has taken multiple twists and turns, and all for the good and all for the better. But there were certain patches along the way where I wasn't sure if I was going to blend in, fit in, or stick around for various reasons, mostly to do with me. Because as I'm going to try to pound into the consciousness of anyone who will listen to me, my alcoholism today does not exist in a bottle. My alcoholism today exists within my, between my ears and inside of my soul. And, you know, my recovery is about how I live my life and how I treat my fellow human beings and how I interact with the world. None of this is what I came in here for. I wanted the heat off. I wanted the pain to stop. I wanted people to stop telling me what to do. I wanted people just to leave me the hell alone, which is what I always wanted. It's a little hard when you're blowing up your life in every possible direction. And you're hurting people and harming people. You're getting behind the wheel when you're intoxicated. You're breaking things. You're smashing things. See, I look like a relatively calm, mild-mannered dude right now. But in my cups, I'm an unlovely creature. I'm a pee my pants, puke up my guts, you know, vicious, violent, drunk. I'm not that happy-go-lucky, you know, carefree alcoholic. You know, I get mean, I get violent, I get very ill. And I take it out on other people. Anybody who's in my midst, whether or not I know you, whether or not you said something to me, perception, reality, it didn't matter. I snapped pretty quickly. And the reality is, I don't remember half of what I did or said. I had to ask a lot of other people what happened the night before. And those periods, you know, of not remembering, blacking out, got greater and greater near the end. I also got into these periods where I was browning out. And those were the freaky, forget about blacking out. I mean, I would be in a place talking to somebody. I don't know how the hell I got there. I'd snap into consciousness. And I'd have a drink in my hand. I was in a room, I don't remember how I got there, or maybe not even recognized. Talking to people, I don't remember starting a conversation with, but I knew I was midway conversation, and then just snap back into, you know, a blackout. And then wake up in some strange place with some strange person, not knowing how the dents got in my car, if I could find my car, you know, the bruises and the blood marks were, the scratches, you know, all that good stuff. And not really good, but the pain just kept heaping on. And my problem was I thought there was a way that I could fix, manage, and control my alcoholism, my alcohol intake, by how much I was intaking, if that makes any sense. So now I'm trying to manipulate external situations so that I could drink to my heart's content. And I would manipulate these situations, you know, by going to this place at this time. We'd start over here, you know, drinking. Well, let me back that up. There was no really we at that point. It was just me because nobody could tolerate me. I became that intolerable solo alcoholic. But I would start my night over here, maybe alone or over here. You know, I'd start at this bar. I would start with this drink. Like, I was always looking for the formula. And then the jukebox, man. Don't get me started on that one. That was like a whole hour, you know, escapade. Because if I had the right songs and the right melody, you know, and if I did this and that and arranged everything in such a way, I wouldn't get as drunk as I always got. And what happened was I got drunk anyway. And I got drunker. I was consuming more. I was in desperate straits. I was in so much pain. I was so alone. I was so scared. I was so frightened. And no matter how much I tried to wish or will it away, I couldn't. Alcohol became my life force. You know, it ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. I had to have it in order to function. At least that's what my mind told me. And then there was the physical dependence on top of it, too. And the funny thing about alcoholism is, you know, comparing myself to a non-alcoholic, a safe average temper drinker, if you will. I'm married to one of these people. Beautiful woman. Love her dearly. She is not one of us, thank heavens. And she doesn't understand. And, you know, it just cracks me up. Because time and again, we'll go out to a place, she'll order a cocktail, maybe two, maybe two. This is the kicker. She doesn't finish all the drinks she ever gets. I don't understand that. You know, and then there's this other, you know, thing we go through, and it's a whole, like, the glass is beating, the condensation's dripping off, you know. So it means it's been sitting there for a little while, right? Because it's usually an ice drink, it's a mixed drink of some sort, some neon flavor, I don't know. I ask, but it doesn't retain it, because I don't really, I love you, dear, I don't care. Because it's not, you know, it's just not in my wheelhouse. I don't even understand half of the things they make anymore. Regardless. She'll sit, she'll stir, you know. And then somewhere about 15 minutes after she gets her drink, again, something I don't understand, she will take a swig of it. I let a few minutes go by and I ask, because just trying to be the good husband and caring, you know, individual, and sweetheart, how was your drink? You know, it's really good, a little sweet, but you know what? It's just really too darn strong. I don't know what that means. I don't understand that. As a full-blown late-stage chronic alcoholic, I never met a drink strong enough. And to try to wrap up the hopelessness and horror of my late-stage chronic alcoholism, you know, I'm drinking Seagram 7 Straight Warm No Chaser. One, because it just got me drunker that much quicker. Alcohol is bloating me and slowing me down. I was also a college student, so it was pretty affordable by comparison. You know, I couldn't go to other off labels because, you know, that would have been bad news. But, you know, here I am just walking around my little bottle. Not little. It was a big bottle. And life just did not get better. Nothing I was doing was providing me or anyone else in my orbit with any amount of happiness or contentment. And yet I thought that there was a solution that I could put into my body in some way that was going to mysteriously and miraculously make me feel completely and utterly whole. It never happened. Because my issue and my problem is that I am trying to fix an internal condition with an external solution. Over and over and repeatedly. And I'll probably get into some of those other things rather than alcohol that, you know, formulated my alcoholism for a number of years. But regardless, I was this empty, God-sized hole walking around. I was a zombie before they were cool and hip and on every, you know, movie and, you know, TV show you could possibly find. You know, I'm just this walking corpse, you know, shambling through life, you know, looking for the next drink, the next escape, the next fix, the next whatever, so that I didn't have to feel me or live in my own skin. I was uncomfortable in that place. I hated looking in the mirror. I hated everything about me, and I couldn't stop what I was doing. I got to the jumping off point, and I tried to kill myself twice in the span of 2 months. I woke up in Morristown Memorial Hospital. Well, now I don't even know what it's called. I forget, but you know, you get the gist. It's up there. It's right off the highway. And I'm in the intensive care unit because I had about an hour to live before I got there. You know, it was, you know, fueled by alcohol, which started it. I'm mixing alcohol and pills and some other, you know, and some pretty heavy dose pills because I was having some health issues. So I had some antidepressants and antiepileptic, and I forget what I had, like a cocktail of three of them things. How I survived that is still beyond me, and yet I walk out of rehab saying, I don't know if I believe in God. God doesn't exist. You know, that's hocus pocus, mumbo jumbo stuff. Anyway, I laugh because there's so many other circumstances in my life where I look back and realize that the hand of God, you know, rescued me from the pits of insanity and death more than once. And that was certainly one of those times. And even then, I still said, meh, it wasn't that bad. I'm on the flight deck and they're like, hey, you want to go to an AA meeting? I'm like, hell no. But, you know, I didn't say that out loud. I said it in my head and I said, yeah, I'll do anything to get off the psych ward with these nut jobs I'm, you know, trapped with all day long, forgetting that the door is locked from the outside. I can't get out any more than they can. You know, I'm on a psych ward for a reason. There's something mentally wrong with me. There's something physically wrong with me. There's something also with many different ways wrong with me. You know, suffering from a spiritual malady, which manifests itself in a physical and mental and physical, you know, form. And I can't see that because I'm so blocked because you're taking something away from me. And I'm so limited in seeing what is possible and what is potentially available to me beyond the bottle. But I can't see the end of the bottle because I'm still trapped inside this, you know, utter insanity of believing that this is going to fix me. I just need to find the right way to do it. About a month goes by or so, and then I finally get to this, you know, point, and it wasn't a big blowout or anything that, you know, terrible happened. Yes, it was a blackout, and I woke up in my childhood bedroom wondering how I got there and kind of pieced some of it together. And, you know, it was just this moment of clarity that I had that, once again, God entered my heart and my soul and said, after months of people indicating possibly and potentially that I'm an alcoholic, actually they were telling me outright that I was, which I didn't really like so much. And I try not to do that today either. It's a self-discovery process, you know, with the first step. I go away to rehab. I'm there for 28 days. I come out, and then my journey into Alcoholics Anonymous begins. I've been here ever since. I may have mentally quit multiple times. I don't even know what number home group I'm on. I don't know what number sponsor I'm on, partially because some moved. Some weren't really sponsors. They were just a name only. One of the first sponsors I had, he went to bed at like 9 o'clock, and I'm just getting out of a meeting, and I'd wake him up all the time. I'm like, yeah, this isn't working. You know, I had two sponsors at the same time. They didn't know they were both sponsoring me. I mean, I've learned so much from the mistakes I made, and how I'm still walking sober is, you know, beyond my comprehension, other than the fact that, again, divine intervention. So I came here, I don't know, about a month or 6 weeks ago. And just want to say, you know, I was at this meeting's inaugural, this group's inaugural meeting about, well, we were trying to put it together, and about 12 years ago. It's just great that it's still continuing, that the message is being carried and being delivered. Mark asked me to speak some time ago because I came here and I regrettably opened my mouth. And I've been really struggling with what to say or what to do ever since. I have no idea what's going to come out of my mouth. I've kind of got a rough outline of where I'm going to go, but really it's up to God. You can blame Mark for anything that I've said or done wrong because, again, I say this because, and it's with a bit of trepidation, for the fact that I know there's been a lot of powerhouse speakers that have flown in here, flown through here, cycled through here, not literally flown. And what I've noticed over the course of the last, and I guess the pandemic, like everything else and with everyone else, has made me take a step back and reach an inflection point. And what I noticed when meetings started to reopen again, and I'm back in the throes of a lot of big book meetings, is that there's a lot of layers that are potentially put on the book that I'm not sure really exist. Now, that's great if that's an interpretation or somebody sees something. I just come from it at a very bare bones, brass tacks, you know, no holds barred, no frills, Alcoholics Anonymous recovery. Because the simpler I keep this thing and the less complicated, you know, the happier I am. I don't have any, you know, I've had my own journey and my own discovery with, you know, recovery and spirituality that's not necessarily in the book, and that's fine. You know, for me, the steps are outlined in a very precise and specific and direct way for a reason. And, you know, and I just look at it, and I'm going to start with this. Because when I came in, I wanted to know what this was all about and what was in it for me. You know, that was, why am I here? What am I doing here? First of all, I had to come to grips with that I was an alcoholic. And looking at that first step, you know, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives become unmanageable. Okay, sure. Yeah, my life may have gotten a little crazy and a little, you know, nutty, but was it unmanageable? Well, how many friends did you have left at the end? You know, who was still talking to you? I used to joke, and, you know, unfortunately, the crowd has gotten younger in the rooms, but I think there's a demographic in here that would remember this. You know, I used to be able to have a party in a phone booth. You know, that was my catchphrase, because it was so true. You remember phone booths, right? Yeah. You know, and that was, you know, seriously, nobody wanted to be around me. I didn't even want to be around me. So why would anyone else want my company? You know, every girlfriend I ever had broke up with me. I was just, you know, again, not at a good spot. But it was that powerless part that really kind of threw me. And I wanted the blood test, the DNA. I wanted the CAT scan, the MRI. I wanted something, anything to definitively tell me that I'm an alcoholic. And then you know, the book and you people say, well, that's something you have to figure out for yourself. And I'm like, ooh, I hate you. Even more than I ever hated you. Because I didn't like AA at first. I love AA today. Just let me put that out there. But what I had to understand in looking back and realizing all the damage and chaos and confusion, there was just this little factor that was left out that I couldn't possibly understand. And I didn't really see it until years later when I finally plunged into the big book. And that's the fact that I have the mental obsession coupled with the physical allergy, the phenomenon of craving. And then once I put alcohol into my system, because my mind tells me to do so, because I think it's a good idea, I don't know, the weather, it's raining, it's sunny, the dog's sick, the dog's well, she left, she came back. You know, whatever the situation or whatever excuse I had in my head, I would take that drink and then a whole bunch of chain reactions would go on that I couldn't possibly see or fathom or understand. And I became the cucumber that became that pickle, and I couldn't go back to ever being a cucumber again. Once I crossed whatever line it was from being a safe average temper drinker into a full-blown late-stage chronic alcoholic, that was it. The game was over, the jig was up, and I was, you know, stuck with who I was. And I wanted to know exactly, and this was my problem. I looked back. When was that invisible line? When did it, you know, why? Why? How? That was, you know, the guys were like, kid, does it really matter? You know, does it matter when you get diagnosed with, you know, any other fatal chronic illness? You know, no. Okay. You know, if you have diabetes, does it really matter when it happened? Or does it matter, you have a diagnosis, you know what the problem is, and you have an opportunity now to start solving it. Okay, that makes sense. And I say all this because it was the people that listened to me, and many of them were out in this parking lot right here, you know, for hours and hours and hours and hours. We would leave in the summertime. It was, you know, still light out. Next thing I know, it's like, you know, I don't know, 9:30, 10 o'clock, and it's getting dark. We can't even see each other a few feet apart. And I'm forever grateful for those people. And, you know, again, this is where I kept saying, all right, maybe I'm an alcoholic, maybe I'm not, but what's in it for me? And it was, you know, over a period of time that I started to realize that as I was going to meetings and hearing people share, and I used to joke that the only time I thought about alcohol was when I was at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's what everybody back then was talking about, how they can't drink, how they're, you know, how it's whatever. I just go to a meeting and I'm like, and it was in that room, and it probably somebody had planted the seed because I was only a few months sober. But I remember looking at the first step, and as you all know probably better than I do, there's only one half of one step that talks about alcohol. The rest talk about something uttering completely different. They talk about a transformation and resurrection of the soul. They talk about living a life beyond my wildest dreams and expectations. They talk about, most important in the first clause, about having a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And I used to think that was like some really pie in the sky, impossible task to achieve. I thought there was no way. First of all, I was pretty godless when I got here. Second of all, I didn't know what that looked like. But it wasn't until years later that I started to dig into the book and then realized that a spiritual experience is just the ability to see the truth about alcohol, its destructive path, and to, you know, start moving into a different direction and living in the sunlight of the spirit, whatever that looks like. The freedom from bondage of self. The freedom of thinking about me 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days of the year. It gets exhausting. It's draining thinking about me, what I want, how you're going to do it for me, how I'm going to come, manipulate, lie, cheat, and steal my way to get what I want. It is exhausting, and it has nothing to do with alcohol. And I say that because there was a period of time where I was about 5 years sober, untreated alcoholism. And I wanted that spiritual experience like nobody's business. I wanted the end game because I had wandered around Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, for a while. And it was frustrating because I was still stuck. I was the same guy that I was when I got here, and I was only getting worse. Sober up a drunken horse thief, what do you get? Just a better horse thief. You know, and I'm doing things and I'm behaving in ways that I'm not happy or proud about. It has nothing to do with alcohol consumption. It has how I'm living life and how I'm perceiving it and how I'm treating other people. So yeah, I wanted a spiritual experience. I wanted a spiritual awakening. And I wanted a prana. The one thing that I was taught from jump and early on was that second part. You know, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. You know, and I was taught that, a great mentor, he's still in my life today. And it's always about who you're helping, how you're helping them. You know, what is, you know, that's what's in it for me. Because, you know, again, just looking ahead and a little taste of flash forward here. When I look at working with others, that first line, you know, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. Sorry, page 89. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. But here's the other part of that. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. I want something that ensures my immunity from alcoholism. The more time I spend thinking about me, the more danger I'm in. The more time I'm thinking about you, the less time I'm thinking about me. And it's so utterly true. And I love the fact that I can just be a vessel and a channel for watching other people's lives change and grow. And just being, you know, that, again, just the vessel for God to reach out and touch someone else's life is just a gift and a miracle. Again, nothing I came in here for. Nothing I wanted. Because, what's in it for me? What are you going to do for me? How are you going to get me better? You know, what, you know, it was always about me. And, you know, it kind of brings it back to what it talks about in the foreword to the third edition at the bottom. Each day somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic shares with another alcoholic their experience, strength, and hope. I probably botched that second phrase up, but the point is that I get more out of sitting knee-to-knee and toe-to-toe. But I can transmit something I don't have, so I have to understand what I am and who I am in order for someone else to start recognizing, you know, their own alcoholism. I used to hear this term qualify. You know, we qualified this alcoholic. And again, my experience is I had to qualify myself. I had to come to my own terms and conclusions that I suffer from this disease. And doing that, there were certain things ahead. Now, I can point out, I can guide, I can highlight. I mean, there are so many people that told me their stories, and their life is just nothing more of anything short of mine. They're blowing up everything. You know, they're burning their life to the ground, but they don't think they have a problem with alcohol. I can't do anything about that. I'd like to. You know, I want to sometimes smack people around and, you know, grab them by the lapels and put them up like, what is wrong with you? But that's not going to do any good. You know, the same way that it was done for me. I had to come to see my own. But I can't get to, you know, helping others until I take some really close look at myself and understanding the 12 steps. And I think one place where it's really overlooked, you know, we obviously have the 12 steps written down. There's, you know, this, that, and the other thing. I think Bill's story on page 14 is a great summation and a great overview of the 12 steps, what they do, and how they help shift and change my life. And, you know, the preface to this is that Bill went through the equivalent of the 12 steps 3 days after he was going in at IDTs. And I still hear, to this day, that maybe they're not, you know, new guy can't possibly go through the 12 steps. And I sit there and go, I don't know about that. If Bill was able to do it, if AA number 3 was able to go and on the third day and do his third step, if Bob was able to go out and make amends with beer in his breath, you know, and so on and so forth it goes, there is absolutely no reason for me to postpone or evade, you know, if I'm an alcoholic. You know, I had to start looking at causes and conditions pretty quickly. I had to acknowledge that I was the end-all or be-all to this world and this universe. That there was a power out there saving my life long before I was willing or able to acknowledge that. So, page 14. There I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood Him to do with me as He would. I placed myself unreservedly under His care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without Him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch. I have not had a drink since. My schoolmate visited me, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. We made a list of people I had hurt or toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. It's a lot of work. But again, there's results or promises that come with doing some work and putting some effort in. And what Bill says is, my friend promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. Belief in the power of God plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Simple, but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of light who presides over us all. And then he goes on later to say that faith has to work in and through us 24 hours a day or else we perish. Nothing about alcohol. Nothing about avoiding alcohol. Nothing about not thinking about alcohol. And more important, because they didn't really have them, about going to meetings and not drinking. Now, meetings are a vital part of my recovery. They're key to what I do. I've been fortunate lately to hit 4 a week. You know, it's great. Fits into my schedule. I'm able to do it. God put me in a position where I can do that. But I live 23 hours outside of the, well, in some cases, a little less than 23 hours. Hour and 15 minutes. I'm trying to make a joke. It's not really landing. Sorry. Anyway, I spend more time outside of AA than I do in it, right? So, am I taking the principles and tools that I'm gaining here and using them in the outside world? I hope so. Because that's really where the rubber meets the road. You know, I can sound great up here, out there, in the parking lot, you know, at the diner, wherever, because I'm with my peers. I know this is the one place where I'm safe and protected. I know it's the one place where I can walk in and meet a complete bunch of strangers, but yet be intimate friends all at the same time. This is the one place that's, you know, saved me and rescued me over and over again. I want to be in my good behavior here because without this, without these meetings, I am doomed. I am going to be in a hellscape of my own creation. Again, I may have mentally quit AA multiple times, but where am I the next night? I'm back at it because I have no other, there's no other stop on the block. I wore out my welcome everywhere else. And despite everything that I did, you know, you guys said to me what over and over when I was new, keep coming. Thank you. You know, but keep coming and change. Keep coming and find a path. Keep coming and, you know, find the inner solution to your problems. And deficiencies, and defects, and faults, flaws, liabilities, and handicaps. Seek an alternative called God, and, you know, things will actually brighten up pretty quickly. Resist, and, you know, you're going to be stuck. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction, right? So if I'm resist, and I had a coach who's telling me this, you know, I hated her for saying it, but it was so true. I persist what I resist. And I resisted whether or not I was an alcoholic. I resisted the concept of God. And, you know, I just kept persisting in this stuff. And it just became worse. And I became so toxic. I was just I was so intolerant. Now, this was dry. This was abstinent. This was without a drop of alcohol in my system. I was not getting well. And it had nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to blame meetings and groups and whatnot. And you know what? I take accountability. Because when I finally got presented with, you know, the opportunity to possibly go through the steps, I'm like, yeah, I don't know. All these people are telling me to just don't drink and go to meetings. I'm gonna kind of hitch my wagon over here. And, you know, that's great, but what do meeting makers make? More meetings, you know? And I need some substance in my life. I need a solution. I need a kit of tools where I can navigate life, because on my own, I'm a mess. You know, I for whatever reason, I just wasn't good working with others as a kid, navigating life with others. You know, I'm an only child. I used to blame it on that. I'm a Taurus too, so the two things. Of course, I'm just going to be an alcoholic and stubborn and belligerent. You know, that's just going to be who I am. But recognizing the problem, now I need to start moving into the solution. And Bill talks about it. And I resisted the second step, you know, like nobody's business. You know, that whole, I'm drawing a blank here. You know, just the God consciousness and the fact that there's a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity. And I think the word sanity just bothered me. I how dare you? Because, again, every action has an equal opposite reaction. If you're telling me I'm going to gain sanity, what are you trying to really imply? That I'm insane. And I hated that. Again, I told you I was on a psych ward. I was in rehab, which was, again, nothing other than a mental institution. But yet, I don't have a mental disease. There's nothing wrong with me up here, but there's everything wrong with me up here. Because of my perception, the way I interpret, and the way I transact and process human relations, you know, it does not compute and add up to the way that a lot of other people do. A lot of people are able to socially be okay. I am not. And it was true that I was insane. And the most insane thing I ever did wasn't all the crazy nonsense that I did while I was actively drinking. Sure, that adds up to it. The most insane thing I ever did was when I was stone cold sober, put a drop of alcohol into my system thinking I'm going to beat the game again. Despite all evidence to the contrary, this time it's going to be different. Despite the 1,000 examples before, this one's going to be different because of all the things and factors that I mentioned before. I'm going to find that right. And it never happened. There I am again, wondering why and how. And, you know, the pity party on top of it. Oh, why me? Oh, my God. I'm so... But I set the ball rolling in each and every situation. No matter how many times I said, I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't do this. Yeah, I could do it. And, you know, the thing was, the magic thing was two. I only had two. I only wanted two. That's all. Whenever the cops pulled me over, you know, the girlfriend caught me, my parents, you know, I'm so, you know... I'm so obviously, you know, beyond drunk. How many did you have? I had two. Probably because that's as high as I can count or how old I thought I was. I'm not sure. My IQ, I should say. Probably not far from it. But I disbelieved God. And I remember my friends and I at one point. How classy were we? We were in one of our friends' Ford Broncos, you know, in the parking lot of a gas station. And I'll never forget this night. It was cold. We had the heat running. But we're just in there drinking. And we're drinking. And we're drinking. And next thing I know, we're getting to this, you know, we're getting into this theological arguments with Augustine and Aquinas. And I'm like, man, we're such, you know, deep thinkers and, you know, heavy. And, you know, we're talking about religion. And I'm just trying. And again, this is where it finally hit, looking back years later. For a guy who didn't believe in God, I spent a lot of time trying to disprove something I didn't believe in. Go figure that one out. I haven't yet been able to put the logic on that one. Why am I fighting and spending so many hours and so much breath trying to disprove something if I don't believe it exists in the first place? Kind of crazy, right? So I have to think that somewhere deep down inside, there was a lingering notion that possibly, potentially, just maybe, in one way, shape, or form, there was something carrying me through. But I was just too stubborn and blinded by my own sense of self-worth and value to actually see it. I talked about a story earlier today with some guy I met at a morning meeting. And it was summer of 87, and me and my friends were about 17, 18 years old. We were at a party in Rahway. For whatever reason, the group of them decided, hey, let's go to Manhattan for whatever reason. I was like, well, there's a keg right here. Why are we leaving a perfectly good keg? Like, I don't understand. But they were my ride, and I had no, you know, I'm like, oh, okay. The girl's house was weird. We had parties. She'd call us. My parents are at a food shop and bring beer. We're like, okay. And then they would come home and like magically clear all the alcohol up, and they would just look around, and then they would go back upstairs, and we'd resume the... It was the weirdest thing. But anyway, we decided to leave beer that was perfectly good and, you know, perfectly tapped, and, you know, it was flowing nicely to go to Manhattan. And me, the alcoholic, was like, I don't know, okay, I'm going to be with alcohol for a little while. So my friend was just driving. It was a late-stage Ford Maverick, thank God. Because we're driving, we're getting closer, we're on the extension, going into the Holland Tunnel. Still to this day, don't know why we were going to the Holland Tunnel. Well, my friends were starting to egg Russ on to pass this one person for whatever reason. I still don't know. He did. I mean, we were already pretty going fast. There's nobody on the road. There's a point to the story. Stick it out with me. So Russ couldn't negotiate to change lanes. He hit the brakes. Next thing I know, we're fishtailing. We're going across all three lanes. The next thing after that I know is that we're looking at the divider straight on. Next thing after that, we're flipping over, and then we're spinning on the roof for about 300 yards. How none of us, other than me, I had a little scratch. I had to get stitches. My dad still holds resentment against Jersey City Medical Center about the bill that they gave for the stitches. But how any of us walked out of that car a lot, and I've seen pictures of that car in recent years, actually about a year ago. Russ sent it back around again. Hand to God. And yet, I'm coming out of it. No, there's no God. God doesn't exist. You know, that's all hooey. And, you know, time and again, people were like, again, saying to me. And what the shortcoming that I give the fellowship at the time, and I will lay this on them, is nobody asked me that one question that's in We Agnostics. And I wish they did. And I always try to bring it up when I'm talking about the big book. Because I could have answered in the affirmative. And it says, do you now believe, or are you willing to believe, you know, in a power greater than yourself? I'm willing to believe that. I'm open-minded enough to believe that. I can't give it a definition at that time. I can't, you know, lay a particular concept. But I'm willing to believe. Because I'm starting to get, you know, open-minded enough. But, you know, I'm still hearing different things. And I had a sponsor. God bless him. He's still around and still sober. But he was fighting with me that I had to have a definitive concept of God before we can move forward. And he almost killed me. Well, what he was teaching me almost killed me. Listen, he's a great guy. You know, he's done a lot. And, you know, he helped me tremendously. But that was the one sticking point. You know, and it tells me time and again that the concept of God is, you know, open, broad, roomy, inclusive, all exclusive, never forbidding to those who earnestly seek him. I couldn't seek because I had to, you know, argue with somebody who was closed-minded to whatever my great concept was. And my concept over the years has changed, ebb, flowed, you know, has had different names. I still can't define it. I just know there's something out there and I'm not God. I'm not my own higher power. I rely on something bigger, better, and you know, greater than I ever possibly could be. You know, I replace the spirits, you know, as we say, with the spirit. And whatever that looks for me at any given moment, you know, is good. And, you know, and I remember looking at the third step and, you know, make a decision to turn our will and all lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And I thought that was like some sort of, again, I'm young, naive, stupid, new. I don't know anything. You know, all my concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous were so, if I told you all, you'd just laugh and, you know, think I was insane because I was. But, you know, my picture of the third step was there was a group of elders, if you will, in a back room, in cloaks, with candles and incense, chanting. I kid you not, this is my whole vision of what doing a third step was. And I was like, yeah, I'm not down for that. Now, mind you, I didn't ask anybody what the third step looked like. I was just so, you know, beholden to my concept that I couldn't get over it, you know. Anyway, it's none of that. You know, it was a series of conversations and discussions. And there was one guy, Joe, who died earlier this year, God rest his soul, with 35 years of continuous sobriety. And again, fellowship and everything else. And I'm going to wind it down, leaving off with the third step before coming back to some other things with the 12th step. But I'll never forget, I left outpatient, and the counselors there told me that if I left, I would drink again. And by God's grace, that hasn't happened yet. I'm hoping it never does. But I was so upset and overwhelmed. You know, the first thing I did was come to a Friday night meeting because my outpatient was in Summit. And I actually made it here in time because the meeting then was 7:30 and yada, yada, yada. I'm starting to walk down the steps. I'm at the top of the, you know, the stairwell or like right on the landing there. And I'm starting to walk in and I hear this voice say, "Hey, Walt." And I look over and this guy, Joe. Now, I knew Joe for 5 years. He had a business and I was at a place that supplied him with his supplies, yada, yada. So I'd known Joe for a long time and I'm like, "What are you doing here?" And he's like, "Well, what do you think I'm doing here?" I'm like, "Oh, good point. You're probably going to an AA meeting." I had no idea the guy was sober. And again, nor should I. You know, he was living a life, you know, of peace and contentment. And it showed with, you know, the way he behaved and interacted. And, you know, Joe became an early mentor of mine because we had a shared history and you know, new things together. But my third step experience, well, two third step experiences. The first one was, you know, shattering my belligerence because I was out there talking to Joe. And again, it was one of those nights, you know, the meeting ended 8:30. The next thing I know, it's like 9:45. And we're going back and forth, and we're arguing. Well, I'm arguing with him, and he's just laughing. And finally, you know, out of exasperation, much like in Bill's story, when they're arguing about God, and, you know, with between Bill and Eddie, you know, and almost that, you know, choose your own conception of God moment. Jill looks at me and says, "Walt, let me ask you something." And out of frustration, I said, "Sure, Joe, what?" He's like, "Isn't something better than an idiot running your life?" Yeah, exactly. It took me about a minute and a half that he just insulted me to my face. And I was about to go on and go, I'm like, "Wait a second." And he laughed because he realized I got the joke. But I couldn't refute that. He said, "Think about it. Everything you've done up until this point led you to this moment. Everything that you've done in your life, every action that you've taken, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. If you did the opposite of what you always did, you would have gotten a different result, but you didn't. You took one course of action that led to something else. And that led you here to this particular night, to this particular meeting, to this particular group, to this particular conversation. Has anything you've done in the last number of years ever provided you with any happiness? Has anything made you happy? Has any amount of alcohol made you happy? Has any amount of this, that, or the other thing made you happy? No. Okay. So maybe there's something to that." And thank God he shattered that for me. It was the first breakthrough I had. God, I hadn't really thought about it that way in a long time, or ever. It goes back years. Because, you know, eventually, and I didn't really do anything with it, I had to even be pointed out by, I think I was about two, three years sober, that the third step prayer was in the big book. Surprise! I had a big book by my name, so I'll bring it next week. I meant to bring it with you to show this, you know, this piece of... Anyway, you'll see. I never read it as a textbook. I read it for piecemeal things. We used to read the acceptance. Anybody around? Mark probably remembers. Page 449. It's moved to 417, I think. I still remember it's 449. You know, I'd look at it for a vision for you and this, that, and the other thing. But eventually, my third step experience is this. I was now just about 6 years sober. I met the guy that took me through the work in the big book. And we met a new guy at a Cranford Tuesday night. And we told him to come. We picked him up and brought him to Berkeley Heights, which was my home group at the time. And we were going to take him through the first three steps. And my sponsor already said, I could take anybody through the first three steps in 45 minutes. I'm like, okay. Because I grew up in a step a year, you know. I mean, and then, you know, it shortened over time. And let me tell you, don't do a step a year. I don't give direct advice usually, but do not do that. Please don't. Please. I beg of you. And I remember walking in, I was all cocky. "Yeah, we're going to take this new guy through the first three steps. We're going to do it." Like, I had any idea what the hell I was doing. I had no idea. I didn't even know where the third step really was written in the book. I just knew it was somewhere in here. The long and the short of it is, we did take this new guy through the first three steps. Well, my sponsor took this guy through the first three steps. We got to the third step prayer, and a group of about four or five of us, you know, in this rock-filled parking lot, you know, completely dark, bitten up by mosquitoes, recited the third step prayer together. Next thing I know, we get up. And I have this feeling in my heart that I haven't felt, I don't think ever. And you know, it's those promises that he talks about at the end of the third step. And they are just so, I mean, I still get chills thinking about that moment. You know, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we can contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. And it's on page 63 at the top. Reborn. The whole point of this. But I can't be reborn if somebody is not willing to take the time and the effort out of their day in their life to pass that on to me, to teach me and show me what to do, to provide me with the, you know, kit of spiritual tools and lay them at my feet, And then not only that, but to say, here's how you use them. You know, pick and a shovel are great tools, great instruments. They don't come with a lot of instruction, but I can learn a lot from watching other people swing that axe and start digging a hole. You know, the great side of my life today is I don't dig my own holes anymore. I try to cover them up or find a different way out. You know, so again, you know, as we are designed to do, as this thing began with two alcoholics sharing with each other, as Dr. Bob talks about in his story, the four reasons why he does this, and, you know, one of those being, you know, first, a sense of duty, you know, because it is a privilege to do so, because I'm repaying the debt to all those who came before me, not just one person. I don't know what happened to that new guy that we took through the first three steps. I just know that I'm still sober. And because of that, I've been able to now help other people do the same. And just, again, be that guiding force, an instrument in their lives, and not take any credit for whatever happens to them after. I can't get anyone drunk, and I can't keep them sober. All I can do is just be an example. So I'm going to really wrap it up now. There's a line, it comes actually out of no place in particular. I kind of laugh at it because it's in problems other than alcohol. And it's just such a great line. Sobriety, freedom from alcohol through the teaching and the practice of the 12 steps is the sole purpose of an AA group. And I thank you guys for being here for 12 years to continue to do that. And I hope in some way that I'm living up to your standards and your principles and trying to carry that message and, you know, continue to be the beacon of hope for someone else who may be, you know, adrift in the muddy seas of Alcoholics Anonymous or of their own alcoholism, whichever the case is, or both at the same time. I'm not really sure. So I thank you all for having me. I thank you for your attention. I really wanted someone to start throwing something at me if I went about 45 minutes because I can't stand the sound of my own voice. But my passion for this thing and my level of love, despite, you know, everything else, you know, is, I hope, comes across and is conveyed with nothing more than sheer joy, passion, and mystery and love. Because without this, I'm hopeless and I will die a painful, slow, miserable death. And that's just the reality. And on that happy note, we're going to pick it up on the fourth step next week. So thanks, guys.